You are listening to the Gable Media Continuing Education podcast feed, the most entertaining and convenient way for AEC professionals to get continuing education credits, including AIA-approved courses. As a Gable member, just listen and follow the link in the show notes to take a brief quiz and obtain your credit today. Enjoy.
My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Today I'm speaking with Christopher Parsons, founder and CEO of Knowledge Architecture. Christopher leads the development of Synthesis, an innovative intranet platform for AEC firms, and serves as executive producer of KA Connect, which is Knowledge Architecture's annual conference on knowledge management in the AEC industry. With over two decades in AEC technology, including leadership roles at Steinberg Architects and Perkins & Will, Christopher has become a pioneering voice in how firms harness technology for collaboration and knowledge sharing. Christopher Parsons, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Mark, thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. This is going to be a fun conversation. You are the founder of Knowledge Architecture. Can you just share a little bit about what Knowledge Architecture is? And then I want to know more about you specifically. What's Knowledge Architecture?
Yeah, so we're a software company based in San Francisco. We are both known for Synthesis, which is our AEC intranet platform. So if your listeners aren't familiar with intranets, they're basically websites for inside your company. So think of like LinkedIn plus Google, you know, all together in one. So you can search for things in Wikipedia, right? Max all those things together. And so it's a platform that we started building in 2009 and we've just been working on for 15 years. It integrates with a lot of systems that people use like Deltek and Uninet and OpenAsset and a lot of those kind of familiar AEC platforms. So that's the product that we make, but we believe strongly that good knowledge management in AEC is about people, process, and technology. And so we run an annual conference, as you mentioned in the intro. We have a lot of very strong community. This is something we share with Entree Architects, as we believe in bringing community together to share best practices. So we've been running a community through Knowledge Architecture since the very, very beginning of the company. So it's kind of a mission-driven organization. We are privately held. We did not raise venture capital, and we are just trying to build a great company for the industry.
All right. Sounds like some important work and helping our industry move forward. I want to know more about you, Christopher. How did you get started? When did you discover your passion for what you do, and who or what inspired you to get started?
That's interesting. I'll go back to college. I ended up being a history major in college, which was completely unexpected. I went to Wake Forest in North Carolina, and I didn't like history in high school very much because it was a lot of memorizing facts and dates. And
right.
When I got to college, Wake Forest was a liberal arts school, so you have to take kind of one of everything. And I got very lucky to get into Sarah Watt's class. And she, on the first day of class, said, look, we're not going to be memorizing facts. We're not going to be memorizing dates. We're going to be talking about pattern matching and looking at trends and understanding context. And the first thing she did was she drew on a blackboard. This is when I went to school, kind of these three waves, right? And so the first wave was kind of like the rise and fall of the British Empire. And the second one was the United States. And then on the third one, she put a question mark. And her basic point was like, empires come and go, you know,
right?
What's next? Who's rising? What are the arguments for who would be next? What are the arguments for American decline? It may not happen this century. It may not happen next century, but eventually Babylon falls, right? And so that was just her way of teaching, is just like, you don't need to know precisely that World War II was 1939 to 1945 in Europe and 46 in, but you should know roughly when it was, but also understand the music that was going on, the social movements that were going on, just really understand the context and the tapestry of a time. And that'll help you understand history. And I felt that was like, that wasn't a direct line to getting into what I do now, but it was such a fundamental way of looking at the world. So I assumed I was going to law school as a history major or become a history professor. Those are really the kind of two doors, you know, that are open to you. But I graduated in 1999, which was the big hot.com, just like explosion. And if there are people listening that don't know that part of our history in the country, like it was one of the headiest economies we've ever seen. Like people were just rushing to spend hundreds of thousands, if not $1 million, just on websites alone to make their companies digital. So everything was happening in tech. I had been messing around with like HTML and learning some technology on the side. I had one summer kind of interning where they had me build them a kind of rudimentary website. I worked in the language lab as a technology RA. And so like I was technical. I was not a computer science major though, but it didn't matter in 1999. If you could turn on a computer and you had a heartbeat, you had a job in technology. Like they were just looking for somebody reasonable to slot into a job. And I was reasonable.
Right.
So I had to make the decision not in law school. In my final summer job before I graduated, I worked with a guy and he said, you know, you can always go back to law school, but there's something happening right now with technology you should take a swing at. And so I think that was really good advice. I never looked back and joined a technology consulting firm out of LA. And I just traveled. It was one of those jobs where it's you're on a plane Sunday night or Monday morning, you come home on Friday every week. It was a lot, but when you're 22, that was fun. And so I saw a bunch of different industries, a bunch of different cities, was deploying a lot of technology for the first time to companies. Like we'd go into these manufacturing companies who had never had computers and we'd be rolling out networks and then we'd be putting in all of their kind of digitizing their business. Figured out what I really wanted to do in technology was write software, not do kind of like networking. And so started going down that road and then the dot-com bubble burst, right? And we had the dot-com bust.
It first was a boom and then it was a bust.
And that was 2001-ish and also 9/11 hit. And in San Francisco, that just killed the tech industry. For as much as when I graduated, it was like any warm body will do. Now it was like the only jobs were for people with 10 years of experience that were even then taking pay cuts. Like it was brutal. And so I had figured out that I didn't want to commute. I sold my car when I moved to San Francisco and I like walking to work and I want to keep walking to work. So I drew a physical boundary. I said it has to be in the city of San Francisco. And what showed up were law firms and architecture firms. And I didn't know that there were architecture firms. And I know this sounds, I mean, I watched the Brady Bunch, so I knew there were architects, but I didn't know that there were firms with 50 or 100 or 1,000 people in them. Like it just didn't, I just had never considered it.
Right.
And so I took a job at a firm called SMWM, who was the first women-owned kind of large firm in San Francisco, just as a network administrator to kind of ride out that recession to go right back into tech, you know, and back into software development.
Yeah.
But then I never left. I loved architecture. And I loved technology and architecture. I would go to all the lunch and learn presentations. I'd go to all the forums. I'd go to all the project pinups. I went to everything because it was this combination of art and science and politics and history. And I just found the people and the work fascinating. So I ended up staying there for 5 years as their director of IT. I then went to a larger firm called Steinberg Architects, based in San Jose, but I was out of San Francisco. They were about 130 to 150 at the time, three offices. Was their chief information officer, did that for about 3.5 years. But I started really, at both firms, I built intranets and was kind of passionate about knowledge management. It was hard to build intranets with the software we had then, and I thought there was a better way. And so I'd started kind of at some concepts of what would be better. And I also got passionate about knowledge management, which, you know, really took off in NASA and the military and even in law firms, but it hadn't really come to architecture. And it was kind of this idea that we're knowledge-based business. And like, how can we make the best use of our knowledge? How can we learn faster than one project at a time? How do we avoid making the same mistake? Like all these things. How do we grow and develop people faster? And I thought that was fascinating. So I wanted to do that full time, which meant I either had to do one of two things. I had to go to a large firm. I had to go to SOM or Gensler or HOK or someone like that to be their director of knowledge management. Or I could start a company and kind of work with more like mid-sized firms like I grew up in. And I chose the latter path. And that was in 2009. Right as another crash was happening, right as the housing crash was happening. And so in some ways, my career is a history of booms and busts.
You're a master of timing, Christopher.
Master of timing. So yeah, so that's kind of like kind of how I got into architecture and the knowledge management and technology. And I just feel really blessed that the ball bounced the way it did. And I kind of ended up here as a history major. It's pretty cool.
It's a great story. It really is. That's why I ask that story, because it's always interesting. Everybody has a story, right? And everybody has a story of how they got to where they are. And I find those stories fascinating. And understanding someone's background and context allows you to have a better conversation about what they're doing today. You talked about knowledge management. Let's start with the basics. What does that mean?
Yeah, I touched on it a little bit. I like this idea that it's about using people, process, and technology to help your firm make the best use of its knowledge. And firms all do knowledge management. It's the only way they survive. It's the only way you go from 5 to 10 to 30 to 80 people. You have to move beyond the single, you know, if a firm starts with a single founder or three founders, whatever the kind of typical number is, you know, from day one, they're figuring out how do we leverage that knowledge and how do we get other people involved? And how do we take knowledge we've learned on one project and transfer it to another? So everyone's doing it.
Yeah.
The field of knowledge management is just about being more intentional and more explicit and about saying some knowledge is more important than others to make sure that we capture, to make sure that we transfer. Some knowledge may not be in our company that we need to go out and acquire to make ourselves competitive. It could be a new piece of software, it could be a new material, it could be a new building code, whatever it is. Like, we have to continue learning and growing as an organization, but then also as people in order to be competitive and to keep our businesses alive. And I think knowledge management says we can do that strategically and we can do that intentionally in a way that, you know, if you think about the basic things, like a firm needs to survive, you need clients. So we've got marketing and business development. You need money. So we've got finance. You know, you need to kind of generate buzz about your firm. So we have marketing departments, but we are knowledge-based businesses. But in most companies, they don't think about it that way, that you can steward it. It's almost kind of like oxygen and we can't see it, but like it's really there. And like there are some really impactful ways to get better at it. So that's what knowledge management looks at.
So the knowledge that you're talking about is all the different pieces that it takes to run an architecture business. The management is taking it and putting it in an efficient, easy to access, easy to understand system.
Yeah.
In a small firm, that might be spreadsheets and folders. Mm-hmm. In a larger firm, it's a more complicated management system, right?
Yeah. And I think the system is important, but I think it's more than just the technology. It's about connecting people to knowledge, whether it's in a system or whether it's in another person's head. So it's also knowing who knows what. It's also subject matter experts sharing what they know, whether they're senior or junior, because we find subject matter expertise at all, you know, ranges of experience, both life and professional experience. And yeah, so it's a lot about connecting people to other people. It's about connecting people to data and sources and making sure that people are aware of what is even available to them and what the resources even are. And you can imagine as firms, when they add a second office or a third office, then how do we know that we've got an expert in Chicago that I can tap into, you know, when I'm in Boston or something like that? Like, there's just some missed opportunities. And so it's getting better at connecting those dots.
Your partial access code is Y. Your partial access code is Y.
Practically, how does that work? How does your system do that? Synthesis is your platform, right?
Yeah.
So how does Synthesis do that? Let's say it's a firm of 100 people and they have three offices throughout the nation.
Yep.
What is your system actually doing?
Yeah. So we think of that as, and to be clear, I've said this a couple of times, like there is more to knowledge management than just what Synthesis does, but it's a, if you imagine a website being the kind of hub of marketing, that way we look at Synthesis as the hub of knowledge management. So there's other, you know, like it's Grand Central, there's other trains that go off on different lines. There's other things that happen, but like, it's really the kind of the home of it. We think of kind of three main buckets. One of them is what we call essential content. And this is anything as prosaic as your benefits and your policies and your firm handbook to your project management guides and standards, to your Revit standards and BIM manual, to as you start getting into market sector, like we've got clients that do things like for our retail projects, we're going to have half size sets, you know, we're going to have example terminology. Like if you're new and you've never worked in retail, there's a bunch of jargon and a bunch of acronyms you got to learn. And so all the way across the business, there's this essential content you need to know to do your job. And it's about capturing that, getting that into Synthesis. So if you're trying to visualize it, think about like Wikipedia, right? It's a lot of pages that people can update and keep up to date. You can put documents in them. You can put videos in them. You can put images in them. And then all of that is searchable within the platform. So you're kind of building your own knowledge base. That's a piece of it. Because we're AEC specific, we tap into systems like Deltek and Uninet and OpenAsset, and we pull information in from them too. So we create employee directories of all your people and their profiles. So kind of like what their skills are, where they went to school, licensure, project history, and the same thing on projects. So a list of all your projects, and you can search for them based on market sector, construction costs, or square footage. So finding the right project, if you're about to start one, you can find precedents. You can figure out who the project manager or the designer was in that project, so that you can pick up the phone and give them a call or have a talk with them and get some advice. So that kind of layer one is kind of that knowledge base plus people plus projects. That's the kind of foundation. On top of that, we also do internal communication. So you can imagine internal blog, where people can ask questions, they can share knowledge, they can talk about where the company's going. And then we tackle learning and development as the third piece. So it's a pretty robust system. We've been building it out, for, as I said, for 15 years. But really the idea is it's a one-stop shop for somebody to go and find out how we work, who does what, you know, where are we going, learn skills. That's really what it's for.
So knowledge architecture creates synthesis, which is the platform. Do you also, and you were talking about learning and development as your third one, are you also providing human consulting, or do you have a consulting arm that also helps them manage this knowledge and organize it in a certain way and know what to capture and what not to capture?
Yeah. So I had mentioned before KM being knowledge management, KM being about people, process, and technology. So we try and be a full stack kind of organization. So we have best practices for how to do this. And because we're 100% AEC focused, we've got a thing we call our essential content checklist, which is like looking across all the different knowledge in a business. Like, this is what we've seen. We built that about 5 or 6 years into the business. So it's like, this is what we see that firms capture. They've got these things. You know, your firm is going to be a little bit different, so we tweak it, but it's a good jumping off point. And a lot of times what it does is it exposes gaps in people's knowledge. It's like, oh, we do that, but we've never written it down. We've never formalized our approach. It's like, great, let's capture that. And so we have some tools like that. We have a client success team who works with our clients both during implementation and then after they launch to get their initial knowledge base built and launched. But then as the company evolves and grows, your intranet should evolve and grow with you to make sure that you've got processes and the team and you take advantage of our new technology. So it's a very collaborative one-on-one with our clients, but then we've also invested a lot in a client community. There's an online community where people can ask questions and get answers across different firms for how people are doing things. We have people give tours and do monthly, you know, showing off their intranet, but also talking about process. And then we do an annual conference for knowledge management for the industry where we just like, here are people that are really pushing the ball forward with knowledge management. It's a lot of inspiration on like, this is what's possible and trying to open up people's aperture to like the art of the possible. So that was a long answer to your question.
No, but that's exactly what I was hoping to understand. You know, we're talking to a lot of people who have heard of knowledge architecture, but don't really know what you do or how you do it. And so I love to sort of get into the nitty gritty of it and the basics of it so we understand what we're talking about. Your software platform is very mature. You just mentioned how 15 years you've been developing it. And so it's a very well-developed platform. I also know that software platforms that were developed 15, 20 years ago are getting to the end of their age, right? That they get to this point where they start to get outdated, right? And smart companies like yours need to recognize that and need to understand that things need to change and technology needs to be updated. And sometimes things need to be broken down and rebuilt in order to move to the next generation. So what is knowledge architecture doing in the last few years with this explosion of technology that's coming to us and is very readily available? Architects are starting to use AI and other very new tools. What is knowledge architecture doing to make sure that the future of knowledge management continues with knowledge architecture?
That's a fantastic question. I'm glad you phrased it the way you did. It kind of ties back to what I talked about with the waves in history, right? Platforms rise and fall, right?
Yeah, and we're seeing it. You can see it with other software where they're just chugging along doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And the rest of the world with technology is blown right by them.
So in the first 5 versions of our platform, really the first 10 years of the company, we had been built on a product from Microsoft called SharePoint, which is a pretty well-known platform. And so the deal was like at the time, SharePoint was on-premise. So you had it in your office and we had built kind of a wrapper around it. So we kind of taken SharePoint, but made it work for AEC firms. So that was making it more user-friendly, making it prettier. Let's be honest, that matters to this industry.
It does matter.
We built integrations with software they cared about. We built a search that actually worked. We built analytics around it. And so we built a mobile app. Like we just kept building all the scaffolding around SharePoint. And we got to the point in 2018 where Microsoft was pivoting their platform. They were moving away from on-prem into the cloud with a thing called SharePoint Online. And we had to decide what our future was going to look like. Were we going to rebuild our platform on top of the SharePoint Online in the cloud option, or we were going to build from scratch? And we chose the latter option. We chose to build from scratch. And we did exactly what you said. We took it all the way back to the studs and built the platform back up.
Yeah.
It was kind of fun because we were almost like a startup again. we had all the lessons we'd learned from the first 10 years and all the, you know, one of the frustrating things about building on somebody else's platform is there's just things you can't fix because it's not your code. And so we knew the walls that people were running into, they wanted us to remove, but we couldn't because it was Microsoft under the hood.
Right.
So when we built our own thing, we were able to, we had complete control of the code and we didn't have to tell people, I'm sorry, we can't help you. So that was brutal. So that was a 4.5-5 year project to really rebuild the platform because we had to build a content management system. We had to build the security, like everything. But now we're on the other side of that. We went into general availability with that in 2022. And the kind of freedom and the speed that it's allowed us to operate. So we have a very modern cloud-based platform, to your point, and so that it doesn't get old.
Yeah.
We've actually dramatically simplified the product when we went through that process. SharePoint, Microsoft love features. I mean, this isn't a slag. They serve all kinds of industries. They serve firms with 2 people and 2 million people. Like they just have like a wide gambit and we don't. We're much more focused. So we can make a much simpler product and make it powerful. So that kind of like let us clear out that kind of debt and let us get a new platform kind of going into this decade. And now that meant when the AI wave came along, we were able to ride it.
Yeah.
And are able to ride it. And we are doing that with a brand new platform with code that we completely control. Yeah, I'm glad you asked the question that way because it does happen. And it's a very hard transition to make because we had to stop selling for a couple of years at one point in the middle of it because we don't want to bring people into the old platform. Like, imagine turning off sales and marketing for 2 years. And like, that's a leap of faith.
Yes, that's exactly what I was just about to ask. What was that transition like, both tactically, but also psychologically? Like, you're basically closing your company and rebuilding it and opening a new company with a new product. I mean, it takes a lot of courage.
It was courage. We have a great team. We have a ton of continuity in our team who's been here since the beginning. Many people in my company, several I've worked with before Knowledge Architecture, other companies. So there's a lot of trust. There's a lot of trust within the team. There's a lot of trust in our community. And so one of the things I did when we made the decision to move off of SharePoint and build our own thing, I did a listening tour with every single client, one-on-one, at least an hour. And I said, look, here's where we're going and here's why. Are you excited? Are you nervous? Are you worried about something specific? Do you have some big ideas? And we involve the community in from the beginning in the design and strategy of the platform. And then every 6 months, we were doing progress updates with the community.
That's great.
So they could see it coming to life. And they believed. They saw the vision. They were bought in. We were listening. We were making adjustments. And so we got very lucky that the vast majority of our clients stayed with us through the transition. Of course, we lost a few that wanted to stick with Microsoft or they thought it was taking too long or whatever it was. But like, and I will tell you, I was more nervous about it before I started talking to our community.
Yeah.
And after I did, the first call gave me a lot of confidence. But once I'd done 10 or 15 of those listening tour calls, I'm like, oh, this isn't something we should be scared of. We should be freaking excited. Like people are excited. Like I was getting energy from them.
That's awesome.
Now, that doesn't mean that it wasn't hard as hell. And there weren't a lot of roads where like, I don't know how we're going to get out of this.
They had your back.
They had our back. And like having that kind of belief and that support gives you fuel to power through the hard times. That's what I have found. And so the community was great in getting us over that.
You realized that you weren't on two sides of the table. You were on the same side of the table.
100%. Co-designing. I mean, I really talk about that all the time. We're building some AI stuff right now. And probably more than any other set of technologies we've ever built, we are co-authoring this with our community. They're going to help us understand what's important. They're going to tell us when it's not working. Like, we can't do that alone. It's impossible to do that. You can't innovate by yourself. You need clients who are innovative in order to do innovative work. I believe that's true for software. I believe that's true for architecture too.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. Architects, listen up. Is something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals? Regardless if you have a clinical mental health issue like depression or anxiety, or if you're just a human who lives in this world and is going through a hard time, therapy can give you the tools to approach your life in a very different way. I know this community of small firm architects very well, and I see many of you struggling. That's why I reached out to this episode's sponsor, BetterHelp. BetterHelp is a platform that makes finding a therapist easier because it's online, it's remote. And by filling out just a few questions, BetterHelp can match you with a professional therapist in as little as a few days. It's easy to sign up and get matched with a therapist. There's a link in the show notes. It's betterhelp.com/architect. just use that link, betterhelp.com/architect. Clicking that link helps support this podcast, but it also gets you 10% off your first month of BetterHelp. So you can connect with a therapist and see if it helps you. If you need someone to talk to, consider online therapy with BetterHelp. Click the link in the show notes or visit betterhelp.com/architect. That's betterhelp.com/architect. Thank you to BetterHelp for supporting this podcast and for supporting our community of small firm architects.
Your partial access code is 7. Your partial access code is 7.
RCAT's Spec Wizard is the tool that will help you save time writing specifications. Going through the manufacturer's specification line by line to find the right product leads to frustration and errors. And that's where Spec Wizard comes in. It's a free, patented tool that allows you to select products and options error-free and generate a three-part specification in minutes. Go to RCAT.com, that's ARCAT.com, and try Spec Wizard today. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. So what does the future look like for knowledge architecture and synthesis with this new technology? You said that you were implementing some AI tools. What does that actually look like and how is that going to impact the software in the future?
Yeah, and this is going to sound like a broken record. When we finished that transition, the new platform is called Synthesis 6. So when we finished that transition to 6, I did a listening tour again, because the thing that we did that I think was smart, we did some things that weren't perfect, but like I think one of the smarter decisions we made is we didn't commit to any functionality on our roadmap past the launch of that platform because we wanted it to settle and we wanted to see where the opportunities were. And so as soon as we kind of had gotten that into enough companies' hands, I went talking and said, okay, you guys know what synthesis is now. What's next? Like for you, like what should we be working on? What should we be thinking about? But beyond just us, like for you as a business, like what's concerning? You know, what's exciting, what's concerning? And we just had some really deep, deep talks. And I'm glad we phrased it that way because two things came out. The AI piece came out, which I think was not hard to figure out that should be important to us. But learning and development came out as the second loudest thing from our community is, you know, whatever it is, we've got a bunch of people retiring. We've got to get people up to speed faster. There aren't as many Gen Xers as there are, you know, they're just like pop, just demographically, there just aren't right. That many Gen Xers. And a lot of them left the industry and went into other fields. So it's kind of, we need to train people and get them up to speed faster. We've got a bunch of people retiring. Like learning and development is now fundamentally super important at most of our clients. And so it's like, well, I think we can help with that. So maybe I'll talk about learning and development first, because those are our two big things.
Yeah.
People have used Synthesis as a what's called a learning management system or LMS for years. It wasn't built to do that. And you always know as a product person that you're onto something when people are taking your product and they're going through a lot of pain to make something really important to them happen.
Yeah.
And they were doing like a lot of manual tricks and reindeer games to turn this thing into what it wasn't supposed to be. And so it's like, okay, we can do that. Like let's actually embrace where the community wants to take the product and build a learning management system in. So you'll be able to create courses, assign courses, people can get CEU credits in the platform, all the things. And so that's really exciting. We had already built video. We've got a lot of the kind of key building blocks you'd need to do a learning management system. We just need to stitch them together in a very specific way. So we've gotten most of the way through design on that product. It's going to be going out in 2025 into public beta. So we're excited about that.
All right. Well, keep us posted on that.
Yeah. And then on the AI side, that was interesting because obviously we took a long, hard run at AI back in like 2015. There's a program at Columbia University in New York called the Information and Knowledge Strategy. It's a master's program. And we had been I spoke in that program and taught a little bit. And then we sponsored a capstone project for a couple of graduate students and looking at should synthesis bring AI into the platform and what would be the use cases and what's available. And we kind of concluded at the end of their research project, it's like, it's too early in 2015. It'd be like for the value that we get back, it's too expensive and it's not, the technology's not ready yet. So we sat on it. And then ChatGPT happened.
Yeah.
And all the generative model stuff. And again, we're looking at it. We're like, that's cool. How does that fit into synthesis? How do we not just do parlor tricks? Like, how do we create something actually valuable within the platform? And so two things bubbled to the top. One of them was we do video transcription in the platform, which is like, okay, cool. Video transcription is not that new. it's gotten much more accurate with AI model, the newer AI models, but we also built an AEC specific video transcription model. So it understands it's Revit, not Rabbit. You know, it understands it's ASHRAE, not ASHTRAE.
Right.
And so we trained that model and built it. And so now we're using that to index, you know, and transcribe all the videos for our clients, which is great from an accessibility perspective, which is a huge pillar for us, but it also is great for search. It's making all these videos highly searchable, which is the second thing we're doing with AI is we built an AI search. So you can just ask direct questions on the platform. If people are familiar with Perplexity or the Google AI overviews, mm-hmm. that's a pretty good comp, but it's asking questions of your data. So whether that's data that's in videos or it's coming in from a project management system or it's in a page or it's in a post that somebody wrote, we're finding the most relevant snippets from all that content and then using it to write AI generated summaries and then citing the sources of where we pulled those answers. And then you can ask follow-up questions and really have a conversation with all of your knowledge. And it is pretty magical, I must say. Like just watch all the years of work that people have put into capturing this knowledge. And now you can just ask questions and interact with it. It's amazing. And so we just went into beta this month. So it's been really fun to see it at our first few clients. And we're very excited about it.
I could imagine that clients that have been with you for a decade find that unbelievably empowering to have all of that information and knowledge in the system and know that it's there and can go get it if they need it. They know where to find it, right? There's a system intentionally to find the knowledge that you're looking for. That's the whole point of it. But to literally just say, oh, I just need this kind of thing. I don't even know where to look for it, but I need this information. And within seconds, it gives you the information.
Yeah. I think it's a kind of a golden era for knowledge management because it's this kind of thing we've been working for. For those of us who've been in this field for a long, long time, and now it's just like the sea has parted, you know, in a way. Like it's you'll never look at search again the same.
Right.
And like, you know that you had to like use keywords and type in little weird combinations of keywords to get back a bunch of links. Then you have to open each link and the kind of in your mind synthesize what's going on. Like when you see synthesis take stuff from a video, a post, a page, another video, and combine that into an answer for you, that's like, it's a composite answer. It's just, there's no going back. So yeah. For us, it's like, we're early days on this. It's going to need to get better, but like you can see that this is it.
Yeah. And I think our collective population is also having that mindset shift. I think people are moving from Google search to ChatGPT and Perplexity and those tools and abandoning the old search engines, which is a perfect example of a tool that you think is going to be around forever because it's been around for quote unquote forever. And in a year, people are like, but I don't need that anymore. I'm onto this new technology.
Yeah.
Right. And it's interesting how quick it moves.
And I'm really interested to see the shift. You know, like I would expect if you just think about human behavior that people will still be typing in keyword searches into our AI search for a long time.
Right.
You know, and not like understand that they can ask like detailed nuanced questions, but like they'll get there, you know, but like, so we actually, from a design perspective, the first thing we wanted to do is make sure that it could handle very basic keyword queries very well. And then we optimize for the more complex queries second, which is it's sexy to go chase the complex queries, but actually somebody wants to type in request PTO and get an answer on how to request PTO. Like that right. We should do that first. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So. Yeah. Right. Do the obvious.
Do the obvious. That's right.
So the future, right? So now you're working with these tools that a year ago were the future. Now they're not the future. Mm. They're tools that you're using and you're developing, you're rolling out your knowledge and development tools. What does the long-term future look like for synthesis? And let's just say 3 years, because that at this point is long-term.
Yeah.
What does your future look like? Where do you want to go with this that you're not there yet?
So I've got design going out a year. And then there's kind of like a constellation of possible futures that might happen
yep.
that I'm constantly and we're constantly talking about, but it's unclear which one of those things is going to emerge. So as an example, we're doing releases monthly now, at least on the AI search thing. There's a version of what we're doing in Q1, which is we're going to build more integration. So we're going to integrate with something like Teams, you know, to pull more content to synthesis. Maybe that's what the most important thing is. Or maybe we have to advance queries like how many healthcare projects have we done in Oregon that are 50,000 square feet over the last 5 years that are LEED, platinum, or whatever it is. Like, that's a very complex query to answer. You have to know exactly what data to pull together. So maybe we're answering complex queries, or maybe it's something else that emerges out of our community giving us feedback. And so it's very much like imagining multiple possible futures and kind of doing the thinking, but like not committing to any of it because the community is going to tell us. The learning management one is a little more clear. Like, we're going to spend next year getting this thing to a version one. But again, I have like, I don't know what version two is yet. I have 6 or 7 pretty good guesses on what version two is. It's actually, I used to try and roadmap out a lot further when I was getting started and make multi-year detailed plans. It's actually much more liberating to just be open to the future is going to come.
Right.
And we want to be nimble. The problem making promises going too far out is we don't break our promises.
Yeah.
So now we've committed to promises that may not be the most important thing or the most relevant there. So we just really try and do one thing really well at a time and then see what the next opportunity is.
Yeah, that's a very wise approach. And that comes with 15 years of experience, right?
Yeah. Well, because in the short term, it feels good, right? It feels like clever to say like, and here are the next big bunch of things we're going to do. And here's the order we're going to do them. It's like, cool. But you might get to month 12 in that big smart plan of yours and be like, oh, shoot.
Yeah.
Like, we should not have committed to that.
Well, we're actually witnessing it right now with AI, where everybody thought that virtual reality was the next big thing, right? That was definitely going to be the next big move in the world, never mind architecture.
Yep.
And then ChatGPT came along. And yeah, VR is still very important, still will happen. We'll still will change the way we do everything in architecture. But AI has completely blown that out of the water in terms of what's happening right now. The changes that are happening right now are all AI based.
Your partial access code is 1. Your partial access code is 1.
Yeah. I mean, Facebook even changed their name to Meta, thinking the metaverse was going to be, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was all crypto before then. And like, but if you wanted to talk about AI, I think the thing that is the, seems like what's next is kind of agents and agentic AI.
Yeah, I agree. Explain what that means for people who don't understand agents.
The idea is that agents can take, right now, what I explain with AI search is you ask questions and you have a kind of like a knowledge exchange. And then the next step would be to enable AI to take actions on your behalf. So act as an agent in your personal life, in your work life, whatever it is. And it could be something as simple like, I don't know, I do a query on Synthesis. It's like, who's the mass timber expert in the company? And great, it's Mark. Cool. Book a meeting with Mark for me, you know, next week if you can, so that we can talk about this and reserve a projector. Something, it could be very prosaic.
Yeah.
So very kind of complex, like go research this thing for me, tabulate it away, find me all the different, you know, you can ask very, very detailed questions and send AI out to do work for you. So I think that that's interesting. I think there are use cases that are going to emerge where there's a lot of, you know, we do a lot of repetitive tasks in architecture. There's a lot of opportunity to automate a lot of those things.
Yeah.
That's been going on with technology for a long time, but I think what's different is the ability to have like mass customization of automation. So I, Mark, on this project might need to do something very specific. And I just want to ask an AI, I don't want to have to go buy a piece of software to automate this task or build a piece of software. I just want to ask an AI a very specific question and have it go do that work for me. And I'll probably need to check it at least for a year, several years. But
yes,
like, how can I have like personalized workflow productivity? I think from an integration perspective, it's also interesting to me. And like, you know, we've got partners like Deltek and OpenAsset and the like. And today we build software integrations and we use their APIs and we pull data in and we can push data out. But there's this opportunity for like Synthesis to have an agent and OpenAsset to have an agent and Deltek to have an agent. And for if Synthesis can't answer a question, it can go ask OpenAsset because it thinks OpenAsset probably has the answer and get it back. So there's this kind of layer above the way we currently do integrations with other platforms that seems like that might emerge. I can't say for sure. We're not spending any cycles trying to design that stuff. But you know, you always want to live in the future a little bit and kind of imagine those worlds, but then make sure you're doing like valuable things for people today, you know?
Yeah. So it's interesting what you said before that really the key is to build a nimble team with knowledge and be prepared, right? Understand what's happening around you, all these different possible futures. So when your community comes back to you and says, this is where we want to go, you're ready. You have the team, you have the knowledge, you have sort of some idea of where you would go because you've been thinking about it, but you haven't developed any of it. You have no plan. You have no specific goal that this is where we're going in 3 years. We have 6 different possibilities of where we may go in 3 years. And when we get there, the community is going to tell us. It's a very interesting way to approach development and future of a company.
Yeah, we have a research council also. I should have mentioned that when I talked about the community, which is Right now, it's about 22 people who are kind of long-term clients, generally, who have always pushed the boundaries of both our software, but knowledge management in general. And we get together generally monthly. Sometimes it's a little in between. We have a very active online group with them. And then we get together once a year in person. And we do a lot of exploring those potential futures together. And people dreaming out loud of like what's going to come for Synthesis and beyond. Like they're talking well beyond just what we do. And just living in that space, kind of almost like doing creative writing, you know, together.
Sounds like a fun weekend.
But not committing. You know, that's the thing. It's like you're exploring together and it's like, okay, I've stretched my brain because I've now seen something today that I didn't see before. And maybe that thing never happens, or maybe that thing opens another door that happens down the road. And so it's a juggling act to like, you want to live a bit in the future, but also be planted in today. And kind of you're constantly shifting back between today, 6 months, 3 years, back to 1 year, back to today. You know, it's just like, I don't know, it's like powers of 10, that, you know, the Eames thing a little bit, but with time, you know, you're constantly time traveling. At least in my mind, that's what I'm constantly doing.
Yeah. It sounds like a very fun position to be in. I know running a tech company is stressful. And, you know, running a company that's the size of yours, doing the things that you're doing at times is very stressful, but I can imagine it's also very rewarding to do what you do and to have the impact that you do.
I can't think of anything else I'd rather do. I consider it a very big privilege to get to work with the people I work with on the things I work with, you know, and by the people, I mean both the team, but then also our community.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, I work with people I love and solve cool problems. Like that's the way I look at it. What could be better?
Definitely not an attorney.
Oh my gosh. I think I would have been pretty bad at it. I think I'm much better in the seat that I'm in. I think it was meant to be.
I do. I believe you. I believe that it is meant to be.
Yeah.
Final question. We're talking to thousands of architects. We talked about all kinds of things. You're a business owner. Mm-hmm. You're a technology expert. What is one thing that a small firm architect can do today, right now, today, to build a better business for tomorrow?
I'm trying to think of the way into this without it sounding too San Francisco.
That's okay.
Whether it's spiritual or whatever, it's some kind of introspection.
Go there.
I feel...
You're among friends when you say that word.
I got deep into yoga and I took a comparative religion class in college that I just loved. And I've continued to read about all kinds of world religions and yoga. I didn't know there's the physical practice, but then has this whole spiritual component to it too. And got deep into meditation, all these things. And I think what I took from that is learning how to understand like my intentions and like what, like when I'm having a feeling or a thought, where that's coming from. Is it coming from me or is it coming from the external world? Mm-hmm. Is that placed somewhere else in me or is that something I authentically believe? So when I have a difficult decision, like every morning I get up at 5, I'm an early riser and I sit in the dark with a cup of tea and a candle. And I just sit and think. And what I'm generally doing is like, not even so much thinking, but like listening to feelings, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
And I'm like, am I excited? Cool. Why am I excited? Am I feeling anxious? What's at the root of that anxiety? And to really just get very clear about what I'm thinking and feeling and why I'm doing things. And I think, you know, I talk to younger entrepreneurs a decent amount. And that's where I try and go to that place with them a little bit. It's like, why do you want to build a business? Is it for money, fame? I'm not trying to be judgmental, but it's like, understand why you're doing this. Is this your idea or is this somebody else's idea? Like, and I feel like that just getting clarity on intention and why you're doing things and understanding how to, I believe that we're like feeling machines that can think, not thinking machines that have feelings, you know? And so those feelings are like early, you know, warning systems on like things that are probably really good. And I'm like, I think my subconscious is like the best gift that I have. I feel like if I have a really creative day, I never make decisions in the same day. I let myself get a night's sleep and I get to that sitting place. And now I'm like, okay, my subconscious has had a night to process this. Like, is this still exciting? Is this still terrifying? Like, I hope that's helpful, but I feel like it's that meta thing, right?
It is fantastic advice. And thank you for sharing and thank you for going there. There's a lot to think about with what you just said. And so thank you for sharing that. I think it'll be very impactful for many people. Just the idea of stopping before you start and listening to the thoughts and energy and whatever else. I believe God also plays a part in that. But whatever, you know, helps you get to where you're going, stopping and listening for the answers will help you. His name is Christopher Parsons. The firm is Knowledge Architecture. You can learn more about Knowledge Architecture at knowledge-architecture.com. architecture.com. Also very active on LinkedIn. You can find him at Christopher J. Parsons. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. Connect with him. Say hi. Say that you heard this conversation on the Entree Architect podcast and let him know what you think. Chris, thank you. I appreciate you for coming by and sharing your knowledge here at Entree Architect podcast and all the work that you're doing. I can't believe that you haven't been on the show earlier, sooner, but I'm glad you are. I'm glad you're here now. I enjoyed it. If you liked this episode of Entree Architect podcast, please share a link to this episode with a friend. Either just click the share button or highlight the URL and send the link to this episode with a friend, because that's how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands more architects just like you. Throughout the 10 plus years of Entree Architect, that's how we've grown, architect to architect. So I would love for you to share this episode and all the episodes with one friend every week. We'd love that. And thank you to our sponsors for this episode. We don't have an episode if there's no sponsors. So thank you to our sponsors. Links to those sponsors, which you should go visit and click, and all the resources that we discussed today for this specific episode, they are all available at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Every episode that we've recorded is there, entrearchitect.com/podcast. Go click the links to the sponsors and say hello. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. You should go visit that at gablemedia.com. That is the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community. You can now earn continuing education credits for listening to select episodes of this podcast, Entree Architect Podcast. Yes, AIA CEUs for listening to a podcast. It's there, and many other podcasts are there as well. And you can listen to all of them and get credit. Learn more about our program, Gable Members Program, at the gablemedia.com/members website. That's gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, join us today at Entree Architect Network. That is the worldwide organization for small firm entrepreneur architects. If you own your own architecture firm, you are an entrepreneur architect. You are an Entree Architect. With weekly live group business coaching, yep, we have business coaching there, monthly live business training with AIA CEUs, 2 a month, so 24 AIA credits per year, including 12 of those are HSWs. We have them in the membership. Business resources, all the resources you need to run your business, special session webinars, mastermind groups, and a thriving community of small firm architects just like you. Hundreds of architects are there waiting for you to join. So we provide the support and encouragement you need to succeed as a small firm architect. I know that you haven't been trained as a business person when you launched your firm. That's what we do. Come learn how to run a business at Entree Architect Network. And today you can go join right now for free for 30 days at this link, entrearchitect.com/30days. We'll give you free 30 days for membership. Go check it out at entrearchitect.com/30days, and I will see you there. Thank you for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I want you to remember 3 words: love, learn, share. Have a great day.